Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This episode is brought to you by Reese's Peanut Butter Cups. In breaking news, leading scientists worldwide are conducting experiments to determine if Reese's Peanut Butter Cups are the perfect combination of peanut butter and chocolate. However, it appears the study was inconclusive, as the scientists couldn't help but eat all the Reese's. Because when you want something sweet, you can't do better than Reese's. Find Reese's now at a store near you.
2023 was an excellent year for the stock market. We had a dramatic recovery in the QQQ and the S&P 500. And in 2024, we still find ourselves in this ongoing bull market. Bull markets mean that stocks go up, generally speaking. And that's what we're seeing day after day. Even today, on a red day, the stock market's only down like 0.2%. These are very weak red days. There's a good chance we could end today in the green. We are in a bull market. The S&P 500 year-to-date is up 10%, matching the QQQ's performance of 10.5%. Now, obviously, this is a good thing for investors, and in most cases, markets go up over time. But there is some risk to bull markets, and that's when some companies get ahead of themselves. During every bull market, there's a group of companies that get traded up to valuations that are eye-watering. They're valuations that are so incredibly high, it just doesn't make sense. In this video, we're going to be addressing five of the most overvalued stocks in the stock market. And some of these are ones that you're very familiar with. Costco, trading at a 46 Ford PE. This is looked at as one of the most overvalued companies in the entire global equity markets today. But then we have Chipotle with a 54 Ford PE, an even higher PE ratio than Costco. Then we have Eli Lilly, the drug maker that's coming out with a new drug to help people lose weight. But in the meantime, this stock trades at a 61 Ford PE ratio. Now keep in mind, the stock market, the S&P 500, is at like a 20 PE ratio. So this is a 3x premium over the S&P 500. Doesn't end there. We have the popular Palantir, trading at 73.5 Ford PE. The company's now profitable, but it's trading at over 3x the stock market's ratio. And then we have the boss of overvaluation in this market, which is Wingstop, trading at the incredible forward PE ratio of 117. Now, just to summarize what this means, 117 PE ratio, the PE ratio is the price against the analyst estimates of the next four quarters' earnings. And you combine those together, and you create a price-to-earnings ratio, meaning that investors today are paying 117 times the price of the next 12 months' earnings, while the market in general is trading at around 20. Now, of course, there's a lot more that goes into valuation and future expectations of a company than the forward PE. But the reason that I chose these companies is because their forward PE, this shorthand valuation, is so dramatic that I think it's worth looking at why investors are bidding these companies up so much. What do they see in each of these companies? We're going to break down all of that in this episode and answer the question, are these companies really that overvalued, or is something else going on here? So we have a lot to dive into this episode. Let's go ahead and jump in. Now, before we jump into this episode, I first want to mention something to a lot of new viewers of this show. We've had around 20,000 new people join both of my channels over the past month. So we're having a lot of new people join, and I appreciate you for checking this out, for looking at the content here. But there's a couple things that I think are different between what I'm doing here and many other financial content creators or people in this sphere. One of them is that I show my gains and losses, and I show my entire portfolios every single week. So there is complete transparency with everything I'm doing with my finances and investments. For example, we have the Story Fund here. This is my smaller portfolio that I invest in a lot of tech companies. It's actually just a concentrated group of tech companies, but these are ones that I've expressed opinions on. I've done a lot of analysis, a lot of research. I've had theses and story arcs of how I think these companies are going to develop over the next 5 to 10 years. And then because of Because of this thesis, this story that I believe will happen with these companies, I've made large concentrated investments in these positions. So Amazon being a top position, Netflix, Google, and Microsoft. We have the three biggest cloud players. These are all the big public cloud companies. There's a lot more to it than that, but these are, I think, three companies that really are not going to lose. I just think they're not going to lose. And then I have another big concentrated position here, which I don't believe is quite as popular online, but it's Netflix. I have an entire thesis of why I believe Netflix will make an excellent market-beating investment over the next 5 to 10 years. And this one has done really well recently. But I show the outcome of these investments every single week. So if you subscribe to the channel, if you follow along, you're going to get complete transparency, both the good and the bad. When I have companies do really well, I'll show it. If I have companies that turn out poorly, I'll show it. You'll see both sides of things. I even benchmark this story fund against the S&P 500 on an ongoing basis. So you can see the red line here is the S&P 500. The blue line is the story fund. And you can see the relative performance of these two portfolios as if I were to invest in each one of them. So this is kind of an alternate reality of what would have happened if I had put my money in the S&P 500 instead of my portfolio. For the majority of 2022, when Netflix and Amazon were getting crushed, I was underperforming. This is when Netflix and Amazon were doing really poorly. Then in 2023, Netflix and Amazon had a massive, massive recovery. Netflix is up over 300% since the lows. And Amazon is up way over 100%. So I've actually regained the lead over the S&P 500 as those two companies, Netflix and Amazon, both recovered. And that's where we are right now. Right now, I'm around 8% above the S&P 500. So my goal is to outperform SPY over a 5-year period. And we have 2 more years left. And I'll show you updates and what ultimately happens either way. I also have a portfolio called the passive income. If I load it in here, this one is worth $658,000, currently has $191,000 in the green. This is one where I invest in a lot of high quality compounding machines, companies that I think are steady, predictable. They're ones that grow their earnings routinely over time. And I have an incredibly high standard for the companies that I invest in. And again, I track this portfolio transparently every single week. So you'll see the gains and losses in each position. You'll see my buys and sells. You'll see everything I do. And again, I show all of this transparently, both the gains and the losses, the good and bad, every single week, for free, without any type of paywall or anything, just on my YouTube channels. And the reason that I do that is because I think there's so much more weight when you show what you do rather than just giving opinions on stuff. I have real money behind what I'm doing, and I show the real results on a weekly basis. So if you like that type of content, if you want to follow along, you can do so for free. Just follow along the YouTube channels. Now let's go ahead and jump in to the most overvalued companies in the market. And we're going to start off with one that hits close to home. This is a holding that I have. I currently own Costco in my portfolio. In fact, if we jump back over to the passive income portfolio here, I'll show you my holding just for transparency. We have Costco here. It's a $62,000 position, around $28,000 in the green. Now, I've owned Costco for some time, so I was not buying it at this valuation, but I still hold all of my shares and I haven't trimmed any, even though it's traded up to a staggering 46 forward PE multiple. Now again, this looks really expensive. Any company trading at a 46 forward PE is going to raise a few eyebrows. And when I look at Costco, this does look expensive even for me when I've owned the company for a long period of time. Keep in mind, the benchmark that we're comparing our holdings against is the S&P 500, which the current estimate of the forward PE right now is 21.5. So you can buy the S&P 500 at a 21.5 forward PE multiple, or you can buy Costco at a 46 forward PE multiple. That's the trade-off here. Costco is a little over twice as expensive as the S&P 500. Now, of course, this multiple, again, is only one aspect of valuation. And I think one of the biggest things that investors miss when doing these type of comparative analysis of the market against another PE of a company is context. There's always a lot of context missing. So what I want to do is give some context to Costco and look at some things that may make the valuation make a bit more sense. Every company builds a reputation over time with the reliability, defensiveness, and consistency. And Costco has built a long-term reliable reputation. And we do the same thing with every aspect of life. If you have a buddy that you're lending money to, and he never seems to pay you back on time or as much as you lent him, after a while, you may be more resistant to lend money. Whereas if you have a buddy that you lend money to, and he always pays you back right away with the full amount, you're more eager to lend that person money. That is your credibility, your reputation over time. And we do the same things with companies. Not just their credit rating, but overall as an investment profile for the company. For example, when we look at Costco, we look at a company that's been through troubling times throughout history. The dot-com bubble right here, the financial crisis right here, we have COVID right here. So we have three huge world events and many other troubling times, you know, in the midst of this. And Costco has grown its revenue through every single time period. The dot-com bubble affected them in no way. They just kept growing. Wasn't a problem for Costco. It was a problem for other companies. Many companies had their revenues go down dramatically after the dot-com bubble. But then we also had the great financial crisis. And this is even more surprising. Millions of people losing their jobs, unemployment going up to 8%. This was the biggest financial crisis in US history for like the last 100 years. And Costco grew revenue. It grew revenue during this time period. It had almost no troubles, especially comparative to the rest of the market. Costco continues to grow revenue steadily. It ebbs and flows over time. It's not a perfect chart, but it's pretty flawless. And then even a pandemic, shutting down companies left and right, Costco was one of the companies that was not only in trouble, they benefited from crisis. They were a company that actually gained market share during crisis. Because when the world is on the brink of destruction, when it feels like it's the end of the world, you realize that a company that provides the basic essentials is more important than ever. Costco sold the toilet paper. They sold the Clorox. They sold the basic foods at the best price. So people were clamoring into Costco's to get their food. But then even outside of these type of events, in normal conditions, Costco does great as well. Costco does incredibly well also during record inflation. So you have other companies that have a lot of troubles during inflationary time periods. Companies that are reliant on financing. Inflation makes things more expensive, especially if you have interest rates going up. Financing is more difficult. Costco is a natural inflation hedge. Whenever prices become higher, they just pass the cost on to the consumer. So Costco doesn't have any issues with inflation. In fact, inflation just speeds up their revenue. So what you have here is a company that is proven time and time again, it's immune to crisis. There's no crises that hurt Costco. There's no world events, no wars, no pandemics, no famines, nothing can hurt Costco, and nothing's proven to hurt it in the past. Even inflation, fiscal policy, interest rates going record high, it doesn't seem to matter what is going on with the economy. This company is just a constant money printer, earning more and more money every single year. They've also maintained an impeccable reputation amongst the government, cities, customers, and investors during this time period of being a company that is basically indestructible to any type of market environment. So right off the bat there, there's some factors that Costco has that not many companies have. It's hard to argue that there's many companies that are as reliable and consistent and dependable and immune to destruction and different events as Costco. Another very unique thing about Costco, which I believe makes the company deserve a bit of a premium over the market, is not just its revenue, but the way that the company earns money. We know that earnings per share are what drive a company's stock price over time, right? As the earnings per share grow, the stock price will go up. Well, the way that Costco gets its earnings per share is different than basically every other retailer and most other companies in the market. Costco has the ideal business model where a lot of people assume that they make most of their money, their earnings, through sales. We can have the sales right here. This is how Target makes their money. They make it through sales. This is how Walmart makes their money. They make it through sales. They buy merchandise from suppliers and they sell it for a higher amount and they get the net income, which is the difference between. That's their margins. That makes up some of the income, the net income for Costco, but not all of it. That's around 40 or 30%. So if you look through their earnings per share history, the sales is probably this top part right here. That is what makes up the sales. The other bigger portion of this, the 60% being left at the bottom here, this is earned through their membership. So you have a membership here, which is a nice euphemism for subscription. So Costco makes the majority of their earnings per share through their membership subscription, which helps support the stock price. So even if their sales go down, as long as people stay members of Costco, they'll still earn over 60% of their earnings per share. Meaning that sales variability, if the sales go down like a few percentage points or whatever, that hurts a little bit of one portion of Costco's earnings per share. But they still have their membership is where they get the majority of it. And over time, this has made their earnings per share on a yearly basis far more reliable and predictable than most other companies, especially because they have a retention rate that's consistently at 93%. So the majority of members stay members every single year, that retention rate's going up, and they gain more and more members every single year. And a bigger percentage of their members are Black Card holders, which spend more. So Costco has all of these secular drivers, making their earnings per share more and more stable over time. And as we know, stability, reliability, predictability are things that investors love. They'll pay a premium for a company that's highly predictable like Costco over one that's widely unpredictable. So these are other things that I think bump up the premium of Costco over the market. Now again, I bring up all of these points to not excuse companies trading at higher valuations, but just to give more context, to give possible explanation of why investors are bidding up these companies in particular. The last point I'll bring up with Costco is that most of the companies in the stock market have a lot of leverage. Leverage means that they're in debt. They're at 3-4 times EBITDA. And that puts them in difficult situations if their net income or their cash flows go down. They still have to pay the long-term debt. They still have those obligations. In many cases, they have to renew them at higher interest rates, putting a lot of companies in a difficult situation. Costco has far more cash than both their long-term debt and leases. They are a cash-rich business, which means that even if they were to get no financing, if every single bank turned them down and said, no, we don't want to do business with you, the economy's too crazy and unpredictable right now, so we're not going to give you a loan, Costco would be fine. They don't need a loan. They're not relying on anyone else. They'll never put the shareholder in danger of the company's financial and capital position. And they do this by maintaining an excessive amount of cash. They always have a lot of cash. If we look at this on a quarterly basis, they actually had so much extra cash that they paid it out in a huge special dividend. They said, we have way more cash than we even need, so we're going to pay out a $15 per share dividend, which is like an entire year of earnings in a dividend. So their cash balance went down last quarter, went down from $18 billion to around $10 billion. But even after the cash balance declining, they still have twice as much cash as debt. So we have a company with a long-term reputation of surviving and even flourishing during any troubling times. A company that has incredibly predictable, reliable subscription earnings per share growth. And a company that has a balance sheet with double the amount of cash as they have debt. This is a company that's looked at as the market is like a juggernaut. It's just unstoppable. There's no force on planet Earth that can stop Costco. So again, this isn't to excuse the valuation, but trying to give context here. Now, when I look at the valuation, even despite all the qualities of Costco, I still think it's a bit expensive because it's trading above where it historically has. When I look at the valuation of this company, typically it trades in the high 20s. So let's say like 27, and between that and around 36. That's where I see this company trade, somewhere between a 27 Ford PE and a 36. So having it currently at a 46, I think is a bit too high. Even with all the qualities of Costco, I think the company's a little bit overvalued here. Now, since I bought into this company and I'm holding it and there'd be tax consequences of selling it, there'd be some frictional costs, I'm not selling my shares. But I would not be buying into Costco today at its current valuation. I would be waiting for a dip or for it to get back to its historical valuation range. I don't think it's going to stay at a 46 Ford PE forever. I think it'll become a little bit cheaper in the future. I do think the company's overvalued a little bit today, but not to the extreme a lot of investors think when given the context of the company. Now, moving on to overvalued stock number two, we have another one that hits close to home because it's one in my portfolio. It is Chipotle, with a staggering valuation of a 54 forward PE. So again, these are not trailing PEs where the earnings have grown over the past year. These are forward PEs. Chipotle's at a 54 forward PE, which As a reminder, the S&P 500 is at 21. So you're paying over 2 times the multiple of the market to own Chipotle. Chipotle's trading at such a high valuation now that it's drawn the attention of many people online on Twitter and on YouTube. In fact, one of the popular YouTubers, Jeremy from Financial Education, has a short position on Chipotle currently. He's betting that the stock will go down, mostly because of the valuation. It's a high valuation company, and I completely understand wanting to have a short position on it. And I also don't have any problem with that. I've been somebody that's vocally defended short selling over and over again on my channel. I have no problem with short sellers. I think anybody should be able to short any company they want. They should be able to bet that stocks can go up and stocks can go down. So I don't take that personally at all. I don't think short selling's bad. I don't have any problem with it at all. But when we look at Chipotle, it is a stock that has various opinions. I'm currently holding my stake in the company. I haven't sold any shares of it. And there's people that are observing that it's at such a high valuation that it's now a good short. And you'll see that opinion expressed online. And of course, what I want to do with Chipotle is give this stock more context around its valuation. The first thing that I think about Chipotle is there's not many companies that have this many secular trends working its way. A secular trend is like a long-term trend, something that's changing in the world that's going to continue changing that direction over the next 10 years. One of the long-term trends is there's more couples working, more dual household incomes. Back in like the 50s and 70s and 80s, you had the dad working and the mom staying at home, and that was kind of the picturesque, ideal situation back then. Well, the situations change. Now there's more women in the workplace than ever. This is backed up by every data that we can look at. So there's more dual household incomes, and that means that there's more busy people going to work that need quick lunches. They're not going to be at home prepping their lunch. When you have that type of secular trend, it means quick service restaurants are going to benefit from it. And I see nothing slowing down that trend. There's another secular trend that's happening and has been happening for a long time period of people having less kids. People used to have like 5 or 6 kids and now they have 2 or 3. And again, this is backed up by all the data you can look at. So you have more people working, earning higher incomes, and then you have less children per household. When you look at a company like Chipotle, Chipotle is in competition not only with other restaurants, but especially with cooking at home. That is their primary competitor. What we see right now is that cooking at home is becoming less efficient, monetarily speaking, for households. If you have dual income and less time to cook and less kids, you're going to be more inclined to buy stuff at restaurants than you are to cook at home. That all benefits companies like Chipotle. Chipotle already has 3,381 restaurants. Thousands of restaurants across the globe already established with great cost structure. And last year they opened up 271 new restaurants. Almost every single business day of the week, they're opening up a new restaurant. Every time they open up new restaurants, without fail, they get paid back in less than 2 years. So the returns on new restaurants are really, really good. And then they're also growing same-store sales in all of their existing restaurants. And they're the largest restaurant chain in the world that's wholly owned by the corporation. Other restaurant chains like McDonald's are franchise. So Chipotle also has more control over the cost structure of their restaurants. So it's a company that's already at scale. It has huge secular trends. They have margins increasing every single quarter, and they're growing revenue every single quarter. Every single day, they're opening up new restaurants, which have a very fast payback period. This is a company that has almost every metric possible moving in a positive direction. So Chipotle may be an overvalued stock. It's trading at a very high multiple, but it's also a company that has a lot of secular trends working in its favor, and it's growing its intrinsic value, its profitability, its free cash flow per share every quarter, year after year. Intrinsically, it's worth more every quarter. And that's very difficult to time when the stock price will come down to meet the intrinsic value, when the intrinsic value is a moving target in the positive. We've seen this in many cases in the past. Companies that are really good companies that are trading at lofty valuations, in some cases continue to go up and up and up because they're growing intrinsic value. With Chipotle, I see the potential of that continuing on for a very long time period. So even though Chipotle is trading at a very high valuation, I think it's a bit dangerous to bet against a company like this. Now, there's some other things we can look at. The revenue growth is only part of the story here. Chipotle grows revenue quite fast for a restaurant. Over the past 5 years, it's grown at 15% per year. I think it will grow continually above 12%, around that 15% range. But we also look at the free cash flow of the company. We know that they had a huge problem with food poisoning. That's what caused the cash flows to go down, the same restaurant sales to go down dramatically. They're cut 1/4 back in 2015. But since then, they've implemented the industry standard safety protocols. In fact, better than industry standard. There is almost no chance of a repeat of that happening. Chipotle is doing things with their blanching, with their sous vide, with all of these different methods to make sure that they have no undercooked food, that they have industry standard safety protocols. So I see very little chance of this type of event that happened in 2015 repeating. And if we zoom in over the past 10 years and look at the growth of the free cash flow, it's been astounding for this company. They also do a lot of buybacks, so the free cash flow per share is growing even faster. On a free cash flow per share basis, Chipotle grew at 46% year over year. So again, even though the stock price is moving up quickly, the best intrinsic value estimator that we can look at, the free cash flow on a per share basis, also went up quite a bit year over year, 46%. It went from $30 to around $44. If we look at the free cash flow, it went from $844 million to $1.22 billion. And the predictions are, at least my prediction, is Chipotle will have around $1.5 billion this year. So they're going to grow their free cash flow again while doing buybacks. Now, again, it's at a high valuation, a high multiple. Maybe the multiple comes down a bit, but what we see here is a company improving its core fundamentals, the actual fundamentals. The free cash flow per share are growing very, very fast. I think Chipotle is a situation where if you're short the company, you're looking for a bad quarter. You're looking for a situation where their metrics come in a little low and their guidance a little soft and the stock sells down 10-20%. As someone that has a long position on it, what I'm looking for is over the next 5 to 10 years, I want a company that's a long-term secular growth winner. So this can work both in the short term and the long term. It just depends on your investment horizon. Now, number three, we have an even more overvalued company than Costco and Chipotle. We have Eli Lilly trading at a staggering valuation of a 61 forward PE ratio. So this is around 3 times the multiple of the stock market today. Now, Eli Lilly is not a company that I own. So we're venturing into categories here of ones I don't own. And I want to look at this company as unbiasedly as possible and see the context around this valuation and why investors have bid this company up so much. So we look at a 61 forward PE. And what you're expecting out of a company that has this type of valuation is investors really like the predictability and reliability of growth. They view it as a long-term secular compounding machine. Or there's some specific catalyst in the not too distant future that investors are starting to price in as a real reality. When we look at Eli Lilly, it is that second option. It is a fact that Eli Lilly is one of the companies that stands to create this new drug that is supposed to be a blockbuster drug. It is in the category of the new weight loss drugs. We've heard of Ozempic. Eli Lilly has one called Mounjaro. Now, to realize the gravity of this situation, you have to look at the US and the obesity rates. It's a serious problem right now. There's so many people, for whatever reason, whether it's society and culture and social and genetics and, you know, the food we eat, all that type of stuff. And if any company comes out with something that can help with obesity, that's going to make a lot of money. Lots of people are going to try it out. And we see that already with the amount of people using these drugs. The numbers are astronomical. Eli Lilly, for example, coming out with this new drug is predicted to be one of the biggest beneficiaries of this type of weight loss drug. We have here, new weight loss drug could generate more than $62 billion in 2030 sales. $62 billion. That's what analysts are now kind of projecting for sales for this company. An analyst said Friday as he boosted his price target on Eli Lilly stock to 1,000. So right now the stock is at 700. There's analysts and bankers looking at this and doing forecasts and projections on this weight loss drug, saying that it should trade up from 772 to 1,000. The new price target from the Bank of America analyst Geoff Meckham is almost a third higher than Lilly's stock closing price target of 753. But he says it's warranted given the competitive moat of Eli Lilly and rival Novo Nordisk. They say that the estimates only account for Lilly's, and I'm not sure if I'm saying this correctly, tirzepatide, which sells as a diabetes drug called Mounjaro, and as the obesity treatment, Zepbound. Competitors are trying to catch up, but Lilly is already working on the next generation drugs, including those bringing estimates up to $81 billion in 2030 sales. So if we look at the sales right now, sales is another word for revenue. So we look at the revenue. The revenue last year was $34 billion, and these estimates are that by the end of this decade, 2030, this will nearly double. In fact, it will over double to $80 billion. So revenue is going to over double over that time period, which is obviously going to have dramatic effects on their overall financial situation. This is the type of setup that I personally think is a dangerous setup for investors. You have a new drug that seems magical and it's going to solve all of life's problems, obesity, the serious problem of our generation. This new drug is going to fix that, and this company is going to make all the money from that. And we're pricing the stock right now, today, as though that's going to happen perfectly. In my opinion, there's a lot priced in and a lot of risk in this stock. Let's go ahead and just take a look at some of the risks. When we look at this company, before this drug and before that type of stuff is priced in, it grows revenue, but not that quickly. Over the past decade, it's grown revenue 4% per year, and it's pretty unpredictable. This isn't like Costco, where you have basically no year of declining revenue. Eli Lilly has many years of declining or stagnant revenue. They've had that in the past. So you're pricing in a lot of growth, hoping the revenue will over double, but it has a history of that not happening. So you're really relying on this new drug. Then we can look at the free cash flow of the company. Most companies that I invest in fact, all of them that I invest in, have a nice trending free cash flow line that goes up over time. Those are compounding machines. They grow their free cash flow on a per share basis over time. Not perfectly year by year, but generally speaking, it's growing over time above 10 to 15% per year. I look at Eli Lilly here, and this company has many years of cash flows just stagnating around. From 1999, the free cash flow was like $3 billion. And then in 2013, the free cash flow was $3 billion. So you have a decade of no growth in free cash flows. This is a cyclical or at least unpredictable business, historically speaking. And investors are pricing in a lot of profit growth over the next 5 years on the basis of this new drug being highly effective, not having many competitors that can take market share, and generating enormous sales for this company. And then probably most concerning with any pharmaceutical company is all the risks that come along with selling drugs, things that are highly regulated. They in many cases have lawsuits, they have side effects, they have problems that can happen 2 or 3 years down the road that researchers develop, and then they have massive recalls and adjustments. You have all of those type of challenges baked into this company already, and even so, investors are so excited, they've bid it up to a 61 forward PE ratio. But I think there's a lot of risk and unpredictability in these assumptions. Now, overvalued stock number 4, which trades at a higher PE ratio than Costco, Chipotle, or Eli Lilly, is Palantir. Yes, the popular Palantir. Now, one thing I'll just mention before I even jump into this is I'm not a Palantir hater or lover. I feel like people try to put you in these boxes, especially for a stock that has a huge following. People try to put you in a box of either being with it or against it. You're either on their side or you're against them. And that seems like a very human thing to do. We like to put each other in different groups. It's the same type of thing you observe with sports, right? You're either rooting for your sports team or you're against it because you're on the other side. I don't view any stock that way. I don't view it as having to be with a stock and having some type of allegiance with a stock or being against a stock. I view stocks as opportunities to make money. They're instruments of making money. Peter Lynch said, "A stock doesn't know you own it." And I think that's a good reminder. You invest in companies so that they can serve you, so that you can make money in the best risk-adjusted way possible. You don't invest in companies to show allegiance with them, unless your goal of making money is secondary to something else. My goal is to make money. That is my primary goal with every holding. So I have nothing against Palantir. I'm not a hater of Palantir. And I also have no allegiance to Palantir. And I've viewed it this way since the very beginning. When I first looked at Palantir, when it was trading at $30 a share 3 years ago, I said the stock was overvalued. And I tried to warn investors. At this price point right here, now when it traded down to around $9 per share, right around here, I also came out with a tweet saying, if I was going to invest in Palantir, I would do it now. I tweeted this out when the stock price of Palantir was $9 per share, right there. Now it trades at $9. This was after it jumped up from like $7 to $9 because the company finally generated free cash flow. And I thought that that was a better time to get into the stock than at a price point of $30 when the company wasn't generating any cash flow. So I'm looking at the company and trying to find when there's good value in this stock. And the last time I found good value was at $9 per share. And I really haven't said anything since then. Looking at it today, Palantir is a company that it traded up too highly at the beginning. It went all the way up to $35 per share with having zero earnings, negative cash flow, terrible margins, and the executives selling all of the shares they're granted. So the company was at a very high valuation back then. It's traded down dramatically. Investors lost a lot of money during this time period. And then the investors that continued to hold and buy more shares right here were rewarded with the stock surging back upwards to $15 per share. And then it surged all the way back up to $25 per share. And that's where we're at today. The company currently trades at $25 per share. So let's give some context to Palantir and its very high valuation. And I'll go through what I like about this stock and what I don't like. The first thing that I like about Palantir is that they're in a business that I think is a good place to be right now. This little thing called AI. May have heard of it over the past year. Basically, every company that has anything to do with AI in a meaningful way has been a huge beneficiary of this nice secular trend over the past year. Microsoft, Google, you have Salesforce, you have companies like Amazon that are benefiting from AI, and you have some bigger ones like Nvidia, the main driver supplying the machinery to run AI. And you also have Palantir, which is a company that helps other companies make decisions based on their data intermingled with all of their software that's powered largely by AI. So the business they run is one that's benefiting from a huge secular trend right now. And you can see that that's part of the reason it trades at a little bit higher of a valuation. I think that plays a role here. Palantir is an AI company. There's big trends going this direction. And I think Palantir is uniquely positioned to benefit from that. We've also seen Palantir grow faster than expected. And that's always something that's good to see. Anytime you're invested in a stock and it grows faster than the analysts expect, that's a good thing. Last quarter, for example, Palantir's revenue grew quite a bit. Year over year, it was 19% growth, 19.6%. That's good growth for any company, but especially needed growth for one that's trying to prove itself and become profitable. Having that type of revenue growth, I view as very, very positive. So we have a company that's in AI, it's growing quickly, and it's both growing in different categories of what it's competing in, which is its commercial business. So it's selling to other companies and they have lots of products targeted at other companies. Their sales team is doing a really good job locking down these contracts, but then they also have special clearance to compete with other big companies like Microsoft in government contracts. And they're doing a good job growing in the government as well. So they have two big categories they're growing in, locking down these contracts for different companies. And you can see that show up in the revenue chart. So I like that aspect of the company. Now, if we look at something interesting here, in most cases, you assume that dilution is bad and share issuance is bad, but I want to give some perspective here. When a company's issuing shares above the cost of the intrinsic value per share, meaning if the intrinsic value is $15 per share and the company's selling shares to investors at $25 per share, they are creating intrinsic value. So in this unique case where I believe the shares are overvalued currently on a per share basis for Palantir, I think dilution's a good thing. They are creating value by diluting because they're selling their shares at an overvalued price to investors. So they're getting cash by selling overvalued shares. And they can hold on to that cash in their cash balance. They can deploy that cash and buy back shares if the shares become undervalued. So if the shares trade down, if they go down to $15 per share, then they could do the reverse. Instead of diluting and getting more cash, they could use their cash balance to buy back shares, creating more intrinsic value. So this is one of the unique situations where I don't view the dilution as necessarily a bad thing because they're issuing shares that I think are trading at a very, very high valuation and above what I believe the intrinsic value of the company is. If Palantir had a crisis and it traded down to like $10 per share, right? If it had a really troubling time, that's when I think they should stop doing dilution. Don't dilute shares at $10 a share. Start buying them back with your huge cash balance. So I don't mind the dilution right now, but but I would prefer for them to buy back the shares when it goes down in price. Overall, I think Palantir is a fine company to hold if you're very bullish on it, if you bought in at a lower price, and if you're just holding on to it and letting it grow over time. I don't have really any problem with that, but it's not a company that I personally would feel comfortable buying in at this point. Now finally, in number 5, we have the most overvalued company, possibly in the stock market. It is the boss of overvaluation currently, which is Wingstop, trading at just an astounding multiple of 117 times forward earnings. Now to look at Wingstop, I first want to look at someone that's bullish on the company. This is an analyst, a wealth advisor, Lee Munson, who is giving a buy recommendation on Wingstop just less than a month ago.
I asked my young analyst, who definitely eats hot wings, and he was like, it's much better than Buffalo Wild Wings. They have a less crappy option for that market.
Now, he asked his younger analyst what he thinks of Wingstop, because apparently he's a vegan, so he doesn't eat it anyways. But he asked a younger analyst working for him that does eat fried chicken and french fries, you know, how is it? And his primary argument is that it's better than Buffalo Wild Wings. Just to take a step back here and really look at what we're looking at here. His comparison as a wealth advisor was to say that it's better than Buffalo Wild Wings, which is basically like saying it's better than starving to death. You know, it's better than getting frozen wings out of the frozen section of the grocery store and heating them yourself. I suppose it's better than that, but that's not a strong argument. He literally says it's less crappy than Buffalo Wild Wings. I don't think did I hear that correctly? I think he said it's less crappy.
Much better than Buffalo Wild Wings. They have a less crappy option.
They have a less crappy option. That's a great argument there. The stock that's trading at 117 forward PE is less crappy than the alternative. Now let's go ahead and listen on.
Now here's what I love about it. It's kind of like one of those classic Peter Lynch where it's like, is the story getting better? And then number two, do they have runway? They have a little bit more stores than a Five Guys. They about half as much as Chipotle. You know, I don't think this is going to be the new Kentucky Fried Chicken or some big chain, but they've got another 2 or 3 years of packing on 250, 300 stores before they start saturating America. Remember, it's a cheap franchise to own. They can get you in there for $400,000 to $600,000, but you got to buy 3 of them.
Now that's a bit more convincing of an argument. They're growing the amount of locations very quickly. They're a franchise restaurant where the capital burden is put on the franchise owners, not Wingstop the corporation. So they're making a high amount of income rapidly. So we look at this company as being this royalty type of company, charging their franchise owners a fee, and lots of new franchise owners opening up in hopes to make a profit. So you have a nice recipe of a company growing over time. So that's what's caused the company to trade up to this super high valuation. But there's a couple concerns I have. First of all, when we look at Wingstop and we compare it to something like Chipotle, not to try to compare the foods, because Wingstop makes really tasty food. I think everybody likes fried chicken and french fries. But there's arguably much more competition for what Wingstop's doing than Chipotle. How many companies sell fried chicken? You have Wingstop, you have Chick-fil-A, you have McDonald's, you have Wendy's, you have Burger King, you have basically every single fast food chain that sells fried foods. So Wingstop is one more company selling fried foods amongst a dozen other fast food chains selling fried foods. That puts them in a category that's highly competitive. Whereas if you look at something like Chipotle, I think the basic food offering here is much more unique, especially for a huge chain. How many big chains are there where you can have digital orders, you have an app, you have a loyalty program, you have locations everywhere you go that sells freshly made Mexican food where nothing is deep fried? There's basically no other one in existence. There's smaller ones that are somewhat similar. You have Cava that's much smaller, not everywhere across the US like Chipotle, but they don't face 5-10 different large-scaled competitors like Wingstop. So I view the basic offering of Wingstop as far less unique than something like Chipotle, and I think that's something to consider for investors. Another thing we look at is this company, like many franchise companies, chooses to run with a lot of leverage. You have the company taking on more and more debt to have rapid expansion and rapid scaling. Right now, they have $2.3 million in leases, so they don't have much in leases, but their long-term debt is $709 million, with only $90 million in cash. So around $610 million in net debt. Even their EBITDA last year was $125 million. So right now, their EBITDA to long-term debt is around 5 to 6 times. It'll take them around 5 to 6 years at their current rate to pay back this long-term debt. And for me, that's a little much. That's on the high side. So even though Wingstop could turn out to be a good investment over the very long term, I think the current valuation today leaves very little room for error. I think there'll be better times to buy into this stock if you're wanting to get into it. So as for me, I'm sitting out Wingstop. So that's my thoughts on the 5 most overvalued companies in the market. If you want more content like this, more videos, I'm releasing an exclusive on my Patreon. It's like an hour and a half long, and I'm releasing that today. So you can check that out with a free trial in the pinned comment below. Other than that, I'll see you in the next one.